Welcome to Our Thoughts Tonight. Join us as we chat in a mellow mood about music, philosophy, psychology, and anything else that will come to mind. Enjoy!
We are back on Our Thoughts Tonight. Welcome back, Ishik.
Good to be back. It's been a while. Although I was here on that one episode where I called in, but I wasn't really here. But yeah. So I think we should get straight into it because we have a few values to go with. I think, right? So I think we should start with compassion, right?
I think we should. Yeah, compassion's a good feeling.
Okay. I mean, that's the whole point of it, right? So I'm gonna. Our first value is compassion, but I think I'm going to try to expand it to things like equality and acceptance. And love is a little bit weird. I think we should save love for the romance section. But I think overall, compassion. This is a question for both of you.
All right.
Basically, do you think compassion is something that really is entrenched within human nature, or is it something that's mostly come out of society building or another aspect of whatever, right? Is it something that's more innate, or is it something that's, you know, an extra kind of value that we've, you know, developed over the years?
Is it worthwhile defining what compassion, what you mean by compassion?
Yeah, I'm keeping compassion kind of large right now. So the original idea was equality in a sense of equal rights or whatever, and then you can also consider acceptance, like accepting another person as if that's, let's say, you know, if we're going like tribal and stuff, accepting a person from a different tribe, if we're going like evolutionary standards, or it could just be overall niceness. I'm keeping this one pretty broad, mostly because.
What about empathy?
That also goes, I would say, with compassion.
Similar, yeah.
Yeah, I would say overall, just an ability to care for another person, without considering their, you know, their skin color or their whatever aspect about them, their gender. So yeah, how deep does compassion go?
You want to take it, Sean?
Everybody's looking at me.
So you've got the best answers, that's why.
So I guess I will take it. I think compassion depends a lot on how close you are to the entity with which you have compassion. So if we go back a real long way, say back well before written history, say back to the essential family, very small hunter-gatherer group, I'm guessing that compassion was largely for somebody in the family. And I think in that way, compassion, like a mother, well, I'm not sure if that's love or compassion, but a love of the mother for the child and a caring for the child. And I think even in the animal kingdom, mothers have a certain sympathy for the child. Every once in a while you can see evidence of it, like a chimp or gorilla comforting the youngster. So I think to a certain extent, it's inborn in a lot of creatures if they are very close biologically.
Do you think that, let's say a more cross-sectional sort of compassion, a more general sort of compassion is maybe more, maybe less innate than, let's say, a mother's love, for example?
Yeah, I believe so. And I think the mother's love is a matter of sympathy. And Murat mentioned the word empathy, and they are both aspects of sympathy. But compassion outside the immediate circle, outside the immediate family, is a more learned compassion. And I think that's where humans come in. We tend to have a compassion or can learn a compassion for people we don't even know. It's one of the essential dictums of Buddhism is one, practice compassion for all creatures, not just for other humans, but for all creatures. Mm-hmm. And that can be both an empathetic, it's empathy because you have to will yourself to have that compassion for for somebody that is not emotionally close to you, somebody outside yourself.
It's funny because in that sense, you're basically the conditions that compassion actually works in, at least in this reductionist sort of view, is like, you know, it's less based on the species itself, but more is based on, I suppose, utility, you know, the utility of the baby being, you know, the family unit or you know, same blood, same whatever. It's less so to do with the actual value of compassion, it feels like to me. It seems more compassion for those that are basically as close as it can, like, for example, like a compassion for between like two partners, right, in a tribalistic hunter-gatherer family, right? That's probably more based on utility, I would say, or utility, or the compassion stemming from utility over time.
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I think to a certain extent, compassion at that close a family level is instinctual.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose we should define the limits. So, for example, if you were to put a bunch of hunter-gatherer societies into a city, right? Basically, the realization of how similar they are might surface and create that compassion as well. But I mean, I'd be willing to say that someone is much more willing to, you know, put their neighbor under the door rather than, you know, their brother.
Well, I agree with that. And, you know, you bring up the idea of the first, what you're talking about is the first cities.
Yeah.
And there was a book, who wrote it? Desmond Morris, I think, wrote it. I'm trying to remember the title of the book, but it discussed the transition from hunter-gatherer society into agricultural society, say about 10,000 BC. Okay.
Yeah.
And so what you have is a lot of small hunter-gatherer groups where everybody knows everybody intimately.
Yeah.
It's not much more than a family group. And maybe at the most, maybe 30 anthropologists have decided. But once you throw people into the early cities, and these cities had upwards of, ones had 5,000 people. Like, I think Jericho, they estimate about 5,000 people. But even 1,000 people, after you're in a hunter-gatherer group of, say, 20 or 30, then they're mostly strangers. And Morris's thesis was that this disrupted the psyche incredibly. And yeah, do you have compassion for somebody you don't know and you're not intimate with? And that comes in the learned aspect. And I think that's what started the idea of compassion for a lot of people. And if you look at the axial age of religion, say about 500 BC, when a lot of the major religions started to take form, 1000 to 500 BC, okay? Buddhism, Judaism, they started to teach compassion. And I often am curious as to how much transition from hunter-gatherer to cities spawned these major religions that are teaching compassion. And compassion on an intellectual level, because you have to think about it, as opposed to the instinctual family level.
Yeah, so the immediate thing that comes to mind is Nietzsche and the whole thing where he talks about like how Christianity and the values it teaches, including compassion, are basically, I don't think I agree with this, but it is reminding me of, like, you know, how things like humility and also compassion are excuses for the failures of the monks, basically, or the failures of the slaves. So I don't know if I believe that stance, but I think it's interesting to point out, like, where that compassion comes from. Like, for example, who is making those religions? You know, it's not that surprising that the Jews or the Hebrew people or the people of Canaan who have, you know, who were invaded a lot. It's not that surprising that they would teach compassion, you know, considering that.
And taken into slavery a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. In regards to Buddhism, that's a bit more hard of a question, because that really depends on the Buddha himself, or Siddhartha at least. And with Hinduism, well, that's a whole mystery. That's more or less like a mystery, which how that religion even came about, excluding the Vedas. But I would still like say that compassion in a larger community is, it wouldn't even be possible if there wasn't some sort of compassion innate within humans.
Well,
let's bring Ro here.
I'm gonna chime in with my psychological take on this. Like, this is funny that this ended up being one of the topics that we're talking about today. Because I was just reading about imprinting, which is a psychological concept.
Can you define it?
What's that?
Can you define it?
Yeah, it's like phase sensitive learning. I guess it happens a lot in like Freudian personality theory, where you know you're in the phallic stage and then the anal stage and all of that. So I don't even know if the phallic stage is a thing. I can't remember.
I think it was. Yeah.
There's specifically one that comes to mind. The attachment theory, it's essentially where it starts off, in my opinion. You're kind of attached to your parent from age 0 to 6, and then somehow, I don't know, through, like you said, Sean, like motherly love, and this is all conjecture, by the way. I don't know if any of this is a scientific fact, but I think through motherly love, the child learns compassion. They, by example, they gather what love consists of, what compassion consists of. So you can really see that when love and compassion and all these traits that are, you know, attributed to attachment theory are missing from that early age, they become very evident. A great example of this, in my opinion, which I experienced briefly after the election, was I genuinely felt myself feeling sorry for Donald Trump. Because I and not sorry like, ah, what a sorry son of a bitch. I read his tweet and he's like, see, if I had this many so-and-so votes, I would win. Like, to me, that's just a kid that never was loved. And that trait is still with him. And I think that has to do kind of with the lack of compassion and that early attachment theory. I mean, these things are so powerful, things like this.
You know, that's an interesting observation, because if you observe children, it's the rare child that has compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to the idea of it being learned.
To be what?
To being learned.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Sorry, before you, there's also this really interesting one called the Westermark effect, I believe. Well, let me see if I'm pronouncing that correct. Yeah, Westermark effect, also known as reverse sexual imprinting, is a psychological hypothesis that people who live in close domestic proximity during the first few years of their lives become desensitized to sexual attraction. It's essentially a drive in your system that keeps you from committing incest, which I think is really interesting.
I mean,
that could tie into compassion in a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, I think overall it connects with basically, I mean, there's no really proof for this, but it just makes sense that the closer you are genetically, that just the less inclined you are to even, maybe in an idealist sense, less inclined to even harm the ones that are close with you, genetically speaking. But I'm hearing this, and it's really funny, because it's kind of, so I'm going to go on a different spree right now, but it's really similar to a difference of views that Fichte, a German idealist, had with Schopenhauer, Schopenhauer had with Fichte. But basically, how compassion works and how different opposing peoples work in interaction with each other. So I was learning something about Fichte's basically mutual recognition thing, where he basically says that, like, the reflection of someone else's consciousness against yours creates a sort of social self where you mutually recognize each other's realities, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in this sense, you create your social self, and that's where you get your compassion, where you understand and you need the other person's realization of yourself to really create your higher self. It's kind of, I'm not a big fan of Fichte, but it's very spiritual in that sense, where we create ourselves by other people, and that's where compassion comes from. Where that's innate, that's a whole different question. It's much more spiritual, but it's funny though, because it is true of the chaotic nature of younger children, I suppose, of like showing compassion, like you said, Sean. Like if it's, you know, it's very rare for them to actually show compassion before they're technically taught, I suppose.
Sometimes they do.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. Like, where is that coming from? If they saw from their parents, or whatever. And that's where I would be like, okay, get in the will up in here.
Do you think it is from the parents, or?
I don't know. I have weird theories about compassion.
Siblings.
I think,
siblings.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm a big will believer. You know, I'm a big Schopenhauer fan, so I'm like, I'm all about like the will and the drive that each entity has in their existence, which is chaotic. Like, you know, Freudian id, I suppose you can also compare it to. But I think overall, compassion is a evolution of that same idea.
Yeah,
where I still think it's innate, but I think it's more of an innate idea that can develop over time. And this isn't anything necessarily like worked upon, but you know, if you have a blind driving force within you, right, whether that be, you know, Freudian id or whatever, the will, I mean, at that point, you understand that compassion for others helps you. I mean, compassion in itself is a plus in the actual outcome of doing it. Compassion benefits you. Not a lot, but I would say a majority of the time.
Compassion, even when being expressed in a situation when you're trying to, for nefarious reasons, is actually even helpful. Manipulators. Even if they don't, like, let's say if they're incapable of understanding, or if they're incapable of feeling compassion, they can even fake compassion, at least traits that seem compassionate, to, you know, manipulate. So, I mean, it's a very powerful thing.
So does that mean that you're going back to the idea of compassion as some part of our hardwiring?
I think this is actually going to tie with romance a little bit too, and love overall. But like, for example, I'm going to go on another spree before kind of answering that question. It's like, so for example, people who usually buy into theories of like a blind driving will of humanity usually don't think much about romance. Usually think that's more of a, you know, oh, that's just something that's developed in like, you know, a romantic period or whatever. Like, not true. But I think overall it's, I don't think compassion and love are systems outright in a human, but I think they are offshoots of what humans may already have, like that, like a driving force and a driving sexual energy, if you want to go the love route, I suppose. Like, I do think that once you realize that compassion overall benefits you and it makes you accepted in a social sense, you can argue that's a learned, you know, perspective on compassion.
Well, I would backtrack just a little bit, because I think that love is very instinctual. Not love, you know, the way we see it in the movies. But when you watch in nature, you watch, let's take a grouse, okay? So a grouse will put herself in danger to protect her chicks. She'll lead the predator away from the chicks. A whale will stay by the child until the killer sharks get the child, but she'll put her life at risk. And I think that's an aspect of love.
I think it will see, it's a little bit, I think the question becomes much more difficult to answer with kids, because kids overall are is the basis of life. It's your genetic duty in a certain sense, as weird as it is to say that, it's your genetic duty to have the kid.
Well, I'm talking about the love. I'm just talking about the mother for the child, not the child for anybody else.
You know, I get it, but I would say, like, is that calling that love, I think it's accurate, but
I think the evolutionary expression for that is called kin selection, kin altruism.
Yeah. But like, for example, if love is so innate, then that animal should do the same for another animal who has no ties to the family. I don't buy that.
Yeah. I don't buy that because the kinship is essential to that.
Well, that's what I'm saying, though. So when does it become unconditional love, and when does it become basically the closer you are to the family, right?
Well, it depends on how close it is to family. Let's take any of us watching the evening news, and we see a car crash, and we say, oh, that's too bad. And we have a certain amount of sympathy, maybe some empathy, but we don't go out of control emotionally because of it. But if that car crash involves somebody we know intimately, our response changes dramatically.
So, no, I agree with that. My whole thing is, does that make love innate, or because love is expressed more times than not in a kinship sense and less so in a distant relations sense, is it as innate, or is it mostly coming because of the kinships? Basically, it might sound a little general, but like, you know, if love is really only coming the closer you are, closer the problem is to, or the issue is, or to you, is it as innate, or is that based off more just outright genetics? It's probably both, but
that's, I would agree with that.
Yeah. And you know, I suppose the fruitful question here of what that may imply is like going into the future. I suppose nowadays we're all very isolated, and in a certain sense, people might be losing their bonds with people who may be, you know, friends that are as close as family, right? If you're not seeing them, we're losing, I suppose, the use of expressing compassion, considering that we're so lonely these days. But I don't know, and what that might apply for the future, but that's more of just conjecture.
Well, you know, there was a movement in the 19th century, not a movement, but a general conception among artists and writers that progress, emotional progress, was occurring. Of course, technological progress was occurring, but there was also, apart from that, there was an emotional progress occurring. I mean, you see it in Victor Hugo, you see it in Tolstoy. This idea that the human creature is progressing toward a more compassionate, lovable human creature. Now, I kind of think that our current election may nullify that belief, but I will hold a positive belief that as the human creature moves on, that a larger and larger percentage of people are developing a compassion for total strangers, which is the ideal. That's the ultimate goal. Having compassion, going back to Buddhism, having compassion for every living creature.
Do you have any poems to read today, Sean?
I have a wonderful poem by Shakespeare.
All right.
Dealing with this very idea.
I think we should go to a piece and a poem soon, and then maybe go to the next virtues.
Yeah.
Or values, I mean.
Yeah, next one we should... So I'm going to quickly respond to that, though. What you're talking about, Sean, is actually it's very similar to what we were talking about a while ago at this point, the Schopenhauer-Hegel episode we had, where about the flow of history versus the stagnant nature of history. So whether we're actually, like, for example, like, you know, compassion towards others in a dialectical sense can be like just communism, right? We're moving towards a equal society where, you know, you get what you can do and, you know, you do what you can, right? And, you know, Hegel was in the actual true version of dialectics would be more something like a developing compassion would be definitely be a stage towards that. But for him, the ultimate goal was the self-realization of God. And what that actually means is that's very amorphous because it's Hegel. But, you know, as humanity progresses further into the future, the more we realize that we are one, yeah, that's what, you know, what would be a part of the whole stage of dialectics.
So have you read Martin Buber? Have you read his I, Thou?
No, I didn't have that.
I think you might find that, I will say enlightening, particularly in regards to what you just said, because Buber hopes for is that we all go into a relationship at some point where you say, it's the word pair I, thou, as opposed to I, it. I, thou is where the thou, you're in direct communication is such a belittling word here, but you're in direct relationship, that you're equals, and that you understand each other, both emotionally and intellectually.
Yeah. So that to me is exactly what Fichte's mutual recognition is. Where mutual recognition is where you understand that you create each other's worlds in a certain sense. It's very similar to that. Although I do want to say real quick that I disagree with Hegel. I'm much more of a Schopenhauerian in the sense that I think that overall we're doomed because of our innate just drives. But I do appreciate the at least the hopes of, you know, hopefully one day, you know, post-Trump we can get to a collective society.
before I read the poem, I actually have a little quote here by Buber that I think applies to this. It's from Martin Buber's book called Meetings. It's a series of vignettes about his mental development. And it's a very, very short book, runs about 65 pages. And this is from later on in the book. And he's talking about religious experience, but his religious experience is not Orthodox religion. Okay? So from Martin Buber's Meetings, religious experience was the experience of an otherness that did not fit into the context of life. It could begin with something customary, with consideration of some familiar object, but which then became unexpectedly mysterious and uncanny, finally lighting away into the lightning-pierced darkness of the mystery itself. But also, without any intermediate stage, time could be torn apart. First the firm world structure, then the still firmer self-assurance flew apart, and you were delivered to fullness. The religious lifted you out. And what he means by that is going into that moment of relationship where the self is united with another self. And you may call it God if you want to, but it might as well be a tree in front of you or another person in front of you.
Again, that's really reminding me of Hegel, because it's like it's at least in a, you know, if you interpret it that way, it's you have a proposition, you know, the self interacting with an antithesis, the other person, and together you have a shared self, just community or I guess compassion again being the synthesis of that. And again, as Hegel would say, that would eventually lead to a whole spiritual awakening, I suppose. But yeah, I think that's really important. But I think as we go to the night, I think once we get into pride, I think it's going to be a little bit of a detriment into what compassion may be. But I think before that, before we go into the song,
we got a poem, right?
Yeah, we got a poem.
All right, Sean's going to read us a poem.
This is a famous soliloquy, or not a soliloquy, but a speech from Shakespeare's play, The Merchant of Venice. It is the trial scene at the end when Shylock wants his pound of flesh, and this is the argument against him claiming his literal pound of flesh, spoken by a disguised lawyer. The quality of mercy is not strained; it droppeth as a gentle rain from heaven. Upon the place beneath, it is twice blessed. Blesseth him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis the mightiest and the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this scepter's sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute to God himself. And earthly power doth then show like as God's, when mercy seasons justice. Therefore, Jew, though justice be thy plea, consider this. That in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy.
No one calls me these days. Oh, hey, what ho, Squitch?
Have you finished that big new feature for the website yet?
Absolutely.
Hang on. Oh, that's not bad. It loads pretty quickly. There's every episode on it as well.
Thanks.
What's this button all about?
Don't push that button.
That ain't gonna happen.
No!
Nothing happened.
That's what you think. Waffling Tailors is a podcast all about video games and nonsense. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you find your podcasts, or head over to waffleandtailors.rocks.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, our thoughts tonight. We are back.
You know, really quick, I wonder, considering that we live in Alaska and to us it's night, but to a lot of the world it's more like morning, I wonder if the name
2 a.m. and on the East Coast 3 a.m.?
Yeah, I suppose. It's still, yeah, I would consider that night. So I think we're moving from compassion, right? Mm-hmm. We discussed a little bit of romance, but I think we should still go on it. So I'm just going to say romance and let you guys take care of this for the beginning right now, because I'm interested in your guys' positions on this one.
What about it, though?
But the origins of romance, the origins or how innate it is, or basically what we just did with compassion, but with romance. So love, and if you want to add in a sexual sense, or if you want to add I mostly mean romance in romance.
Population.
Basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say, what's the word? I had a word for it. Anyway, romance.
Origins of romance. I think it comes, I mean, you're going to have to go, I'm going to have to go straight up as usual, you know, like evolutionary. I think it's just I think it's how we experience the evolutionary drive from a conscious point of view, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be totally normal, you know, like romance and things associated with romance are probably very standard, you know, evolutionarily. But to us, it's this experience that seems more than it actually is.
Well, maybe some historical background to the word romance, right, from a literary standpoint. If I'm not mistaken, romance comes from the Middle Ages. And you're talking about a very stylized love, almost a controlled passion or lust, in which started in about the 12th century in southern France and Aquitaine. You've all probably heard of the troubadours, right? The idea of, and troubadours, let me remind everybody, troubadours were actually nobility. They were knights. It's the jongleurs who sent the songs around. But in those courts of southern France, a very heretical section of France, I should point out, with the Albigensians, they made woman, largely for the first time, they elevated woman. Because for the longest time, women were denigrated to second-class citizens. Particularly in the Christian church, when you go back to Adam and Eve, Eve is a seductress. She is the one that drew Adam into lust, into disobedience. And, oh, I should say disobedience and then lust. So the whole thing in the garden was, it was innocent love that after the eating of the forbidden fruit became lust. And that's how it's portrayed, kind of in the Bible, when Adam and Eve decide realize that they should cover themselves, cover their nakedness. And Milton plays on that in Paradise Lost.
Sorry, I just realized I wrote effect and not effect on the title.
What?
Would it be effect or effect?
Wait, maybe the title's name?
Five values that affect us daily. Not effect, right?
It would be a effect.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
My fault.
Yeah.
I got it, though. I got it myself.
Yeah, good.
I'm a big boy.
I think that's actually hitting the head, because I think romance is probably, out of all these five values, probably the clearest in a sort of, in a newer sense. Like, one example that I was thinking with Murat's analogy and stuff with evolution is like trying to compare, let's say, whatever type of bird trying to mate another bird, right? That I'm not a bird guy, so I don't know the different types of birds, but like, dancing, you know, doing the whole presentation of their feathers or whatever, like courting in a certain sense.
Like the birds of paradise do that.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, comparing that, and Murat, when you like how we make it out to be something more than it actually is, you know, that action of the bird is pretty much what we do nowadays. But the whole idea of romance is added on, but it's not really anything
outside of evolutionary drive, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of a stylized lust.
Yeah,
it's stylized,
exactly.
Yeah, like I said. But it's interesting as to why, well, I suppose how I develop, I mentioned the examples there, but I mean, because I suppose the whole Christian mythos might push towards a sort of narrative of romance, but like how that even developed is kind of a weird question.
Well, for the longest time, you know, even going back to the first couple centuries of Christianity, a lot of the church fathers frowned on sex.
Yeah.
And they, what was it, St. Paul said at one of his letters that, you know, if you have to have sex, be married, but it's better not to engage in sex at all.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Which doesn't do much for the population membership of the church.
Yeah.
But it's in the Middle Ages that they started, that the woman started to be elevated, and she was actually the inspiration for good actions. If you look at the Arthurian tales, romance is the inspiration for the knight to go out and do good deeds.
Well, I mean, although within the Arthurian legend, don't you have Guinevere cheating on Arthur?
I know, right. And that's, but see, that's, yeah, that's why it's so important in that, is,
yeah,
because she, and what does that do? She becomes another Eve.
Yeah.
And takes down the kingdom.
Yeah.
Right?
So, should we stay on romance much longer?
I think we should move on pride, because we kind of covered a little bit of love with compassion.
Yeah, yeah.
So, pride. So, how innate is pride?
Wait a minute. Before we go back. Okay. I think we should continue this a little bit more.
Okay.
All right?
This clearly says two people in this room that aren't very good at romance. Or something.
Right. Because I think the difference between the inspiration of the woman, whether she, and this may sound sexist, but I don't mean it to be, because the literary history and the religious history shows this, that transition of the woman from the seductress to the inspiration, I think is really profound.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in the Middle Ages, we also get the rise of the cult of the Virgin Mary.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Which is essential to Catholicism, not necessarily to Christendom, but to the Catholicism that I grew up in, it's essential.
Yeah.
She becomes the mediator to Christ. Now I'm going back to Shakespeare again. And so we take Romeo and Juliet. This is basically lust. You know, it's teenage, get out of my way, I'm in love, right? Everybody spread out, and it leads to their downfall because they're in such a hurry to consummate everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you talk about romance, you think in terms of not so much lust, but bringing the beloved flowers and showing a certain amount of devotion, right? Certainly, when you get into the bedroom late at night, it devolves into lust. But up until that point, there's a certain ritual that it may be falling out now, but I think it really starts to inspire a deeper understanding of love if you go through that ritual of romance.
Yeah, I agree. The thing is, like, I even if we do reduce romance as sort of stylized lust, that doesn't necessarily, you know, reduce the value of it either. It just means that its origins are, you know, might have evolutionary basis. So yeah, the actual inspiration of romance is absolutely valuable.
I think it's essential.
Yeah. Right. And what
otherwise we just become, you know, love becomes bestial.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, that was the case for a long time, but I suppose that wasn't good.
That's true, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, a month ago we were in the rut season for moose, right?
Yeah.
And all the moose up here, all the males, the bulls, I mean, they just thought with nothing more than that thing between their legs, and they just pounded each other, you know, for dominance of the female. And that's the way it is through most of the animal kingdom. But we have ritualized it.
It's funny. This is one example that I keep thinking in my head, and I wish I would remember the story more and clearly. But that it was a Bhagavad Gita, I suppose. That one Hindu story where that princess or whatever burns herself to prove that she was loyal to her husband. I forget that necessarily the steps of that story, but I keep thinking about that and how that ties into romance. But to me, it seems like, once again, it's more of a question of the woman being loyal and is she loyal instead of a question about romance. But I can't really speak too much about
that's an essential part of the Ramayana.
Yeah, there was a Ramayana. Yeah,
Rama's wife.
Yeah.
She does not hesitate to join him in exile.
Yeah. That seems like romance to me, but considering the culture, is it romance or is it more something like the loyalty of the wife?
Well, it's love. Loyalty sounds a little bit too objective. Whereas love, there's both admiration and passion. So it's getting back to the idea of compassion. It's both the feeling and both the heart and the head working in one direction. And I think that's what true love is.
Two things. So the thing is, the reason why I mentioned loyalty was what lesson that story would have taught in those days. Would it have taught love to the people of that time in that area, or would it have taught more of at least in that particular element of the story? I know the story is really more about virtue, the duty of someone, but there you go. The whole story of that is about the idea of dharma, the duty of someone, right? I mean, that can be love, but to me that sounds at least in that cultural sense a little bit more harsh, the duty of the wife.
Well, it is harsh, and that's been the case throughout most of history.
Yeah.
where the wife has been denigrated to second class.
Yeah.
And therefore, yes, it's duty to follow the husband.
Yeah.
But in this particular story, she didn't.
Yeah.
She was given a choice whether to go or not, and she chooses to go.
Yeah.
And that also occurs in the Mahabharata, where the wife chooses to go with the brothers. And yes, she's fulfilling her duty, and she's a second-class human being in that society. But by doing that, the first people who heard that tale would have actually heard it. They wouldn't have read it. They would have heard it. And that would have made her a very admirable character, Gopati.
And also another thing you mentioned with love early on, with passion, and I forget what else you mentioned, but I was reading something about psychology. Murat, you might remember this from one of your classes or whatnot. I forget who it was, but it was a theory about the three aspects of love and how those relate into creating a better love. Like, one of them was passion. One of them was, I suppose, initiative, I think it was. I don't remember. Is that ringing a bell? Like, for example, the whole theory was there's these three values that, for example, if you have none of them, it's an empty relationship. And if you have one, it's a whatever relationship. And the ideal goal is to have all three. I just wish I knew. I think passion was one of them.
I am looking it up.
Yeah.
Well, passion would be essential, I think.
Yeah, I think that was literally one of the values.
Just basic lust.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be essential. But then then you move to less bestial levels.
I think there's an empirical study on this that, if I remember correct, I don't know the exact statistics, but in terms of attraction, the most important thing for both men and women, and it's funny because before I mention those things, you know, the general take that we have or that we think is right as, you know, normal people is that women and men have different types of attraction, when in reality they're actually very similar, which most people don't know or don't acknowledge to be true, I should say. Also, the two most important characteristics of attraction are, number one, physical attraction, and number two, kindness. And there was an empirical study that was done, I can't remember by who. And then another thing was, in marriage, physical attraction is only important to the woman in the first, well, I don't want to say only, but generally, most important to the woman in the relationship for the first 4 years, and then it starts to become less important. And then for the man, it's after the first 4 years is when that physical attraction becomes more of a focal point. So if that there is an absence of that, that's when those absences allow themselves to be shown, depending on the gender, generally speaking.
Does that create a problem?
I think, yeah. And but like you were saying, that's the like lust is very important in that way, I think. But kindness is almost as important, specifically, or both to men and women, but leaning more towards women.
But it not being the number one reason, it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I don't find it a shock. Honestly.
Yeah, it's not, but it's, I think it shows the, maybe the weird sense of romance might actually have, that how it might be just the overall stylized lust, but yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one can wax cynical and say that romance is really just a veneer for lust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you really want to be a cynic.
Yeah.
I have a more positive view of it. I think the ritual of romance is.
I think it's different too.
It's wonderful, I think.
But that's the thing. Even if it is just, you know, lust in a fancy way, it doesn't really demean it in any sense. It's still what it is.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, I asked Zach this question a few weeks ago, and I think I asked Bailey, and I was, I asked Zach, like, what was the question? When was the last time you experienced a crush? A true crush, like, you know, like you felt an elementary school type of crush. And he was like, I don't know, I don't remember. And then I said something along the lines of, it's funny because you don't really experience that feeling of a crush unless you were not prepubescent. Or if there is no opportunity of sex. So having a crush, whatever that would be called scientifically, I don't know, is a totally different feeling in itself, but it's a subset of romance and lust, I think.
Well, I will admit I have crushes quite often. But, you know, it's women I see usually from afar, and I'm attracted to them physically.
That's what I mean. Is that, I mean, there obviously is always an opportunity to have sex. But sometimes it seems, you know, they're at a distance or, you know, they're in a film or whatever it is, but that's a real emotion. And it's almost like a more innocent version of lust because it to me, it doesn't necessarily seem as similar as romance. It doesn't seem romantic where, you know the person, you buy them flowers and that's a more compassion driven type thing. But with a crush, it's a very, it's like a proto lust.
Like hope.
Yeah. I don't know. It's really bizarre.
It's the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah.
Longing.
I think, you guys think we should go to the Pride?
Yeah.
Yeah, with Valerie?
Can we have a poem to include?
Yeah, let's do a poem.
Yeah, let's do a poem.
Another short piece.
Yeah, sure. Wait, which what's the next song, by the way?
Next song is from the same group of monks, I believe.
Okay. Monks.
And it is called Credo 4.
Banger.
Last one was called Terra Tremuit.
Wait, Terra Tremuit? What?
Tremuit. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct.
So world... something. Yeah. Muit. 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 Oh, that sound, Muit sounds so... I know I Latin translated that one day.
Have you heard that one? The last time I said?
I don't know. I don't think so, but...
Can you dance to it?
Probably.
In the grave. Anyway, poem, song, and then back to it.
Okay, so this poem is by John Donne. So I'm gonna try to stick with the Renaissance tonight, because they were very astute philosophers as well as poets. I mean, great poets. And this is one of the great ones from the Renaissance, John Donne. And this poem is about romance, but falling in and out of romance. A Lecture Upon the Shadow by John Donne. Stand still, and I'll read to thee a lecture. These 3 hours that we have spent walking here, two shadows went along with us, which we ourselves produced. But now the sun is just above our head, we do those shadows tread. And to brave clearness all things are reduced. So while one infant loves did grow, disguises did and shadows flow from us and our cares, but now 'tis not so. That love hath not attained the highest degree, which is still diligent, lest others see. Except our loves at this noon stay, we shall new shadows make the other way, as the first were made to blind others, these which come behind, will work upon ourselves and blind our eyes. If our loves faint and westward decline, to me thou falsely thine, and I to thee mine actions shall disguise. The morning shadows wear away, but these grow longer all the day. But oh, love's day is short, if love decay. Love is a growing or full constant light, and his first minute after noon is night.
Million seconds. That's how long the average person is alive for, so please let me have your next 40. If you ever wanted to hear from someone who is facing death row, or if you ever wanted to hear a top competitive chess player, or even a debate between the top newspaper authors on opposite sides of the political spectrum, then give me the remaining 20 seconds. I'm Bill Trofesky with the Way Podcast on FM 91.7 in Connecticut. On my podcast, I interview top experts and specialists on various topics weekly. I have a lot in store, from interviewing a neighbor George Floyd to a doctor who has written a book in psychedelics coming up. Simply go to podcasttheway.com and you can find everything about the show, from links of all my streaming services to social media and more info regarding the show. Again, that's podcasttheway.com. I hope to have your support, and as always, deuces.
Thank you.
Okay.
Where are we?
I think, where are we? Well, that's a different question.
Who am us?
Yeah. Who am us? So we're moving down the list. I'm not sure
I
if
like
we're going
to. The banana's always delayed.
Yeah. That makes it even better.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if we're going to get through this whole list tonight, but I think we're going to hit the topic that I've been waiting. Pride. So I'm going to leave this up again for discussion up in the air.
We are getting a phone call.
Oh shoot! Okay, let's listen in.
Wow. Hello.
What's up, boys? It's Tyrone Biggum. How's it going?
This is Zach.
Yeah, this is Zach.
It's Zach, everybody.
Hello.
What's going on?
Nothing, man. I'm chilling. I'm looking for my controller. I'm at a loss.
Have you been listening the whole time?
Yeah, bro. I clocked in like 1 second before it was on air.
Oh, right on.
I had a
classic.
Number one.
I was counting down like I was sitting there. I was like 10 minutes left.
Oh, you were?
An alarm.
Oh, you must be bored
yeah.
as hell.
Dude, I'm in quarantine, bro.
Right
I ain't doing nothing. I'm reading.
What's
How are you guys doing?
We're doing
I
good.
I'm in quarantine.
Do you have COVID?
No, I don't think so. I'm fine.
Just
exposed to it.
All right. Are you going to be listening? Is Andrea there with you?
Oh, me.
No, it's just me. Asher, say hi.
Oh, all right.
All right, cool. That's tight.
Okay. All right.
What do you guys
we'll
do?
We'll talk to you again in a bit. I'm putting you on
all right,
mute.
All right. Oh, okay. Yeah, fine.
Wait,
what's up?
We should... Once again, we should get Zach's opinion if he's
oh, yeah,
still listening.
Okay,
yeah.
Wait, do you want to start him out? Listen.
Sure. Yeah. Hey, Zach. So you've been listening. You know what we're doing, right? With the whole values and stuff, and like how it, you know, what it means to you know us as people, right? So I'm gonna give this this next value to you to start it off, if you want, huh?
Sure. Repeat
Zach,
it again.
There?
Now? Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm gonna give you a human value, and I just want you to talk about it. Just talk about. Maybe how important it is to humanity and whatnot. I just want you, you know, to hear your thoughts about it. All right.
How important what is to humanity?
So so the value I'm going to give you is pride. So just talk to me about pride real quick. What's your thoughts about it?
Self-assessment, setting goals, wanting to achieve to be something better, maybe for yourself or someone greater, or someone that you aspire to be. pride is...
So you're taking a very positive outlook on pride.
Yeah. And then there's, like, self-absorbing pride. Like, you don't ever want to be wrong or you don't want to lose an election. Something along those lines.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like a dual-edged sword to pride.
Yeah, you're right.
Two different kinds of pride. I think that's actually a good framework, really.
Yeah. Same thing with love or compassion, too. Just like you guys said before. Different variables to the equation. It's just not, it's not one way. Two sides, tea store. What are you doing, man? Help me find my controller.
All right. Good to hear you.
But yeah.
It's been a week.
Yeah, good to hear you guys, too. I know, man.
I think the last time I saw you was last week's podcast.
Yeah, that was the last time I saw you. But I'll let you guys go. I'm going to keep listening.
All right. We'll hear from you in a bit.
All right. See you there. I think that's actually a good intro to actually splitting up pride into two different aspects. I think that's actually a good way to look at this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, even for now, I'll throw the pride ball up and let you guys kind of tackle it right now.
Origins of pride.
Origins and yeah, just origins of pride.
You want to start this one off, Sean? I started the last one off. Okay, I think.
Well, I will go. I will start this with drama in ancient Greece, and I'll preface it with the mention that pride in later dramas. Particularly in Renaissance dramas, pride was considered the tragic flaw. It's what brought the hero down. Right, pride goeth before the fall. But in ancient Greek drama, and when Aristotle discusses in his great work Poetics, what makes the hero fall, he used the term hubris, which I think a lot of people translate as just making a bad mistake. Like Oedipus, yeah, certainly has pride, but he makes just some bad choices based on the information he has. I think most of us would have made the same choices Oedipus makes, given the information that he was given. But certainly he had pride, and pride allowed him to overcome the phoenix and actually become a good ruler in Thebes after that. Or was it Corinth? One or the other, right? And later, but when you get to Shakespearean drama, pride is considered the great tragic flaw. And so it comes from the inside. It's not a matter of making a bad decision. It comes from inside. But really, when you think about it, it has to do more with the ambition of the character. It's not Macbeth's pride that makes him murder the king. It's his ambition. And it's not Richard who murders because of pride. He murders for ambition. Now, King Lear, on the other hand, King Lear divides up his kingdom out of pride because he thinks he can do it. He thinks his daughters will continue to love him, even though they've just given him kind of verbal veneer of what they think of when he asks them, "How much do you love me?" And he determines how much of a kingdom he will give them by how much they love him. And so it's just a verbal response. And they just sugarcoat it, the two older sisters. And it is the youngest child that really says, "I love you," as far as duty. But it's Lear's pride that forces him to expel Cornelia and go with the older sisters. So that's one aspect. That's really pride. Hamlet falls not from pride and not from indecision, but because he actually has a certain amount of compassion. So pride is not necessarily, what I'm getting at in a long way around is pride's not necessarily bad. You can have, though, too much pride. And that's where Coriolanus comes in Shakespeare's play. He has too much pride. And that's his downfall as well.
I think there was I saw something recently that I think is going to tie in with this. It was a TED talk, and it was about basically this guy analyzing trying to like define evil and whatnot. If there's, you know, various means, he mentioned Abu Ghraib, the whole torturing of Iraqi people by the U.S. Military. And one thing that he eventually concludes is that power is really the kicker.
So he's the one that did the Stanford prison experiment.
That one. Yeah. And where power is really the kicker into making someone evil. And by the examples that you gave, Sean, that's each one where it's technically bad, there's a sense of a power in that pride.
Zimbardo.
Huh?
That's his name. Zimbardo.
Yeah, Zimbardo. Yeah. And so I think pride is not overall a bad thing. It's just, it's a little bit obvious, but yeah, it's not overall a bad thing, but it's how you use it and where that pride is necessarily coming from.
And also with whether or not it's excessive.
Yeah.
That was a great TED Talk, by the way.
Yeah, I know. It was the whole Abu Ghraib part really got me, but mm-hmm. You know, Abu Ghraib is insane, but. And although, I think also the answer is given, but, you know, pride being such a bad attribute later on, I'm gonna attribute it a little bit to Christianity and overall religion with Lucifer and Satan and that whole figure. You know, pride goeth before the fall, literally.
Well, that's certainly Lucifer's fall results from his pride in Paradise Lost.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm gonna. Interject the story it's kind of a caveat, and I've mentioned this to you guys before, and I might have done it on a podcast, but the whole story of Satan and how it's a little different in Islam, because when I was like, you know, questioning my religion whenever when I was a teenager, the whole interesting thing was like the story of Satan is different because in the Islamic version it can be interpreted as Satan being the most devout of the followers, because the whole story is basically God creates Adam and God orders all the angels and the jinn to bow down to Adam, and Satan doesn't bow down to Adam. And some people, some interpreters, view that as Satan being the most loyal to God. But of course, most people would just, most Muslims would attribute it to pride again. So, I mean, you know, it's an interesting story, because I think, it's a real, you know, it's interesting.
Well, getting back to Milton, you know, it's actually quite similar, not exactly alike, but it's quite similar. So Satan is. So when Milton begins the poem of man's first disobedience, there were disobediences before that. And one of them was Satan's fall. So Satan falls because he's disobedient to God. And he falls out of pride. However, when he compels Eve to eat the fruit and give it to Adam, Milton interprets that as the felix culpa, the good fall. Because if Adam and Eve didn't fall from the garden, then Christ would never come and true salvation would never come. Adam and Eve were too innocent. They had to grow up. And this is an interpretation that shows up in a lot of places. Yeah. But that's the major part of Milton, is that Satan was actually, yes, still very proud and very disobedient, but he was, well, he acted on, not in God's behalf willingly, but unknowingly.
Yeah.
He was fulfilling God's plan.
Yeah.
Because when you get right down to it, Adam and Eve were a couple, they were duped by God.
Yeah.
They were destined to fall.
Yeah.
And it's Satan's pride that resulted in his disobedience, that resulted in him in his tempting Adam and Eve and their fall, which led to the new, or hopefully will lead among Christians. I'm not a practicing Christian, but to the new Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I've never finished Paradise Lost, but it's funny because Satan isn't even the most prideful character in that story. There is a brief, I think it was only in like the second part of that story, but Moloch, one of the demons early on in the story, is like clearly more prideful than Satan. Where basically they're all the loser demons are like trying to like gather what to do after their defeat. You know. From God and Michael and all that, and they're basically like, okay, what do we do now? And the most prideful of them, obviously, is Moloch, which is like, what did he say? He's like, He's basically like trying to wage war again against God, even though he just lost, right? So it's funny that Satan's not even the most prideful in that story. It's actually, and Satan and Moloch, and it's actually really weird because in the whole conversation of demons in the story, Moloch is almost like ridiculed. Like he's not taken seriously by the others. So I think it's interesting that even the story of Satan, there is like some pride that is a little bit too much. But yeah, I mean, I think still overall pride is over. It's a very intrinsic part.
Well, if you go through history as well, and I'm thinking now in regards to military history, there have been times where pride definitely went before the fall. Napoleon before Waterloo misjudged his enemy entirely. He called Wellington the sepoy general, very belittling terms. And a classic military blunder, underestimating your enemy. Lee, pick a charge, is another one.
Operation Barbarossa, Hitler.
Another one. Yeah, right.
It's funny because when we talk about the bad side of pride, each time, there's a coupled value, that being the belittlement of others. That is always with at least the bad version of pride. Because if you think so highly of yourself, you definitely belittle others. But yeah, I think overall, yeah. Murat, what's your take on pride, by the way?
I don't know. I don't know if I've ever thought about it. Honestly, I don't consider myself a very prideful person. I don't think I have anything to be proud of.
Well, a certain amount of pride.
I'm sure I do. Okay. Yeah.
I think it's just a matter of degree.
Yeah. I think now this is going to sound totally.
Are you proud of your ability as a guitar player?
Not really.
But you're a damn good guitar player.
Not anymore.
But at one point.
At one point, I was decent. Yeah. I guess I'd like to practice, what would the word be? Deference? Would that be? I just don't really like to take credit for things, I guess.
But do you like the idea of the people looking up to you as a good guitarist?
If I was a good guitarist, yeah, I would. But I don't think I am anymore.
Okay.
That's
actually humility.
I guess so, yeah. I don't know. I guess I'm trying to think of something I would be proud of. I guess I'm proud of this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't think I would, I don't think if someone said it sucked, I don't think it would bother me.
How about proud of friends? Proud of family?
Oh, we're getting
proud of your wife?
I am proud of my wife, that's for sure. And she's calling us right now, so. Hello.
Hi.
Hey.
You there?
Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can.
Hey,
I've
Bailey.
Been listening for a bit here.
Oh.
Hi.
Okay.
Hey.
So Bailey had a question she wanted to ask us.
I want to talk about pride first, but I also want to ask you
okay,
questions.
All right.
So I have a contribution. I know Sean's take on pride kind of included like the Christian perception of pride from what I was listening to. And I feel like honestly my Christian upbringing really affects my relationship with pride because I think humility is hugely valued. And I don't know, like as is my traditional system, I get older and then I'm just like forced to rethink the things I just like understood as fact. Like it's good to be humble. And as much as I think it's good to be humble, I also think it's really good to have a strong sense of dignity, So I'm still trying to sift through the balance, but I guess I would say I think of pride largely in a positive way, like it sounded like Zach was saying. You guys there?
Yeah, we're here. Sorry, I dropped my phone. Yeah, okay. So I guess that was directed towards you, Sean.
I didn't hear it entirely.
She said that briefly. It was that with a Christian upbringing, humility is really a huge focus. But she's had to discern, between humility and dignity. In this modern world, essentially.
I agree with that entirely.
That was a really...
That's an astute observation. And pride comes in all sorts of degrees.
Mm-hmm.
There can be pride that's dangerous, but pride that also helps you lift your head and, you know, walk through a crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Pride that's destructive, but pride that also redeems the self.
Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes we're drawn to people that have like a sense of dignity about them too. So if you want people to be drawn to you, you know, you can't rely entirely on deprecation, I don't think.
Okay. Yeah. So
yeah,
we're having some trouble hearing
question?
You. Yeah, I'm going to turn off this fan and then just stay on and we'll be right back. Just one second. So
okay.
Bailey has a question for us, but I'm going to go turn off this fan real quick.
I do have a question. It probably.
Yeah. Murat's going to take it, turn off the fan because it's really hard to hear. Okay. I think it's off right now. Yep. All right, Bailey, what's your question?
All right. Can you hear me?
Yep. Pretty clear right now.
Okay. It is a question I've been just kind of posing to a lot of people in my life, and I don't remember if I've asked any of you except for Murat. Murat's the initial one I got into the discussion.
I think you asked Sean too.
Oh wait, did I ask Sean? I know I asked.
Yeah,
Kataro.
You and the girls were here.
Yeah. Okay. So I've already asked Sean this, so he'll have to just reiterate his answer. I'm sure he's had time to hone his answer if his subconscious has rested on it at all. But essentially, I am just wondering what your perspectives are. And I've also recently asked Russell Brand this question. I submitted it to a AMA thing that he's doing. So my voice asking him this question might be on his podcast. So I'm just trying to ask this question on as many podcasts as I can. But in the instance that the speaker of a statement uses a word that has like multiple connotations, are they responsible to know the different connotations of the words that they're using? Or is their audience that's hearing their statement or that their statement is directed at responsible to clarify the intentions of what is said? And are they responsible to clarify which connotation is meant and what in general is meant by a statement? And I guess like this is kind of a broad conceptual version of kind of just the debate about political correctness, I would say, maybe. And so just wondering you guys' initial thoughts. I know Murat's answer to this question, from what I understand, is that it's up to the audience and it's the audience's responsibility to really clarify the meaning of a statement.
Pretty good question, actually. That's a very complicated question, I think.
It is a complicated thing.
Yeah. Well, what was your answer? You told her before. I'm not sure what your answer was.
Well, I gave her one answer, and it's more, as I recall, it's more or less this. That ultimately, it's a listener's responsibility. Every speaker has a goal. And they could twist facts. They could take on a certain tone, and they can use all kinds of connotations to get their point across. For instance, you know, if somebody's making a political, and we've heard a lot of them in the last month, if somebody's making a political commercial, you know, some key phrases are outside groups, environmentalists, extremists, and that turns a lot of Alaskans away from that vote,
mm-hmm.
right? It's the responsibility of the listener or the reader to get through that mesh of confusion and realize that a lot of these spins are entirely false.
That's actually one thing that I think that you're really good at, Bailey, is finding subtext within things. So it's funny that you would take the opposite position in this question, because I think you're really good at seeing through the obvious underlying emotions of things. Like, especially in movies and books and in certain characters and this and that.
Huh. Well, thanks for the compliment. But I don't think that I necessarily am. I think that that's just my nature, is to, like, wonder if my alternative meaning is what they meant, you know? But I don't think I should have to. I think that just the effective speaker does clarify. And I think that, and I love the example that Sean brought up there about the political ads we've had in this recent election season, because especially the local ones, I feel like on either side of any sort of ballot proposition, there's people just calling the other side funded by dark money and out of state interests. Like, I don't think I heard one political candidate or ballot proposition, ballot measure, whatever, that wasn't at some point on the radio accused of being funded by dark money or out of state interests. It's wild.
Yeah, they're all smearing each other. I want to hear Ashok's take on this.
I mostly agree with the audience position, but I think there's actually a caveat. I don't think it's as clear cut and dry. It depends on the context and the venue that the speaker is in, first of all, and if how much the responsibility is.
What do you mean?
Like the responsibility of for example, the speaker knowing the connotations their words might have and to either clarify during their speech or not. But if it's, for example, in a person, like, for example, like, thank God I'm taking a communications class, but like, it's not so, like, communication is not so cut and dry in terms of I put out a message and the receiver listens and interprets it in their own way. There is a certain bubble that is created within that communication. At least if it's in a person, if it's if the speaker and the listener are in direct communication, if they're like in front of each other and whatever. But so in that sense, where there is a sort of meshing of meanings of what, you know, the speaker is intending and what they're saying and the listener interpreting that, in the combination of that, there is a sort of there is a problem, right? The whole bubble in the middle is a mismatch of meanings, right? I think to a certain extent, it is partially on the speaker to, I guess the simplest way to put it is know what they're talking about. Depending, again, it is really dependent on the context of the venue. If it's a personal talk between speaker and listener, it is, I think I would be much more on the side of, it's kind of on the speaker's, it's kind of the speaker's
Thank
responsibility.
You.
If it's something much more, if it's something much more formal, like in a political speech or whatever, it's absolutely the audience's duty. If it's something more like, you know, let's say like a comedy or something, I still also think it's the audience's duty. On a personal level, it's tough because it is true that the audience can interpret in a wrong way, but. I mean, it's really, I'm sorry, but the answer is not so clear cut and dry. It just depends on the situation. That's literally what it is. If it's a stranger, you should be as clear as possible, but you also don't have to be as clear as possible to a stranger. But if it's someone that you do know, and I mean, I can't really give a concrete answer. It's just, it's not the same answer for each and every context. It's not.
You know,
I'm
going to deal with that a little bit. For the most part, I agree with you on that. But what you're doing is you're asking the speaker to have integrity, and a lot of speakers don't. And therefore, it falls back on us.
Well, not even just integrity. Some people have a language barrier.
That's true.
Right? Or not even a barrier, but they use the same language, but other things mean different things. So there's like colloquialisms will... confuse another person.
Again, the bubble between the speaker and the listener can never be the same. There will always be a difference between the speaker and listener and how they interpret the things. right? The goal of each person, though, should be to align as best as they can. Now, in terms of a lot of listeners not having the integrity, sorry, a lot of the speakers not having the integrity, that's true. But yes, that is true. And in a prescriptive sense, then yes, of course, speakers should be more careful in what they say. But in a descriptive sense, that's just the case and how it is, and we should still be as clear as possible in what we mean. I mean, you can't be so clear to a point where it's a detriment. You can't just, like, you know, define every single word you're going with, obviously.
That was when we initially had this argument, that was my point.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go that far, but it is true that, like, you do have to say certain things. Like, for example, I'm never going to go to, okay, like, I don't know. I can't really I'm not going to go to a guy who I may think is a Trump supporter and talk about, like, labor theory, like labor economic theory or whatever. Or I'm not going to talk about labor in the same sense that I will talk about to another person. Like, there are.
Maybe you should, though.
Well, you know, I can in the context of a debate.
Yeah.
In the context of an argument or discussion. Okay. I cannot casually talk about that with another person. I can if I want to fight. Like, yeah. You know, I mean.
Or start a debate.
I think it just depends.
Well, by the same token, would you go to a site that claims so many Elvis sightings?
Yeah. But for example, I'm going to give a really crude example right now, right? Think of, okay, this is going to be really, I shouldn't say this.
No, you got to say it now.
Okay, now I got to say it, right? If you write doggy in one website, it's not going to be the same as a different website.
Yeah, that
it's
makes
just
sense.
Not. Like, it's not the website's fault. You're going to a different website. You know what you're going for. Again, that's...
Well, the first answer would be, let me give you what you mean by Jesus.
In a sexual way.
Let me give you a more elevated example. I would suggest that everybody go back to the Declaration of Independence by Thomas Jefferson and read that very objectively.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And as you go through it, just question yourself, how much of this is real propaganda, exaggerations of what the British have done to the colonies. Just go through it, and I won't point out any quotations. I don't have them off the top of my head anyway. But just go through it and just read it without any sense of patriotism. Yeah. Right? As simply a document.
It shouldn't be too hard these days.
Well, that's actually the entire nature of the study of law, like the legal study in general, is literally just interpretation of words of law, you know, so that they are expert determining listeners, I would say, of words, lawyers are. I really like what Ishik said, though. Like, I think that's the most clear answer I've gotten so far, because I kind of have been frustrated every time someone's like, it depends on the context, and then they just, like, don't give me any explanation past that why they think that. And I think that that's so true, that in a more personal relationship, I think the speaker, there's a bigger burden on them to explain themselves, because they do know the different biases and the colloquialisms of the person across from them, usually if it's a personal communication. So I think they should be more capable of it. And I think maybe, like, when it becomes controversial and when things get messy is in my experience, like, with people that you kind of know, but, like, you don't personally know. Like, when politicians make statements and when a radio ad makes a statement, you kind of just know that they're speaking to a giant audience, and that to understand what is meant, it requires a little research. But when, like, a friend of a friend does something or says something, and everybody talks about what they said and dissects it, and it becomes kind of controversial, and everybody kind of thinks, wow, they didn't really run with their responsibility to clarify what they meant. It's just kind of like the gray area of that in use of Ishik's spectrum there. So it kind of makes sense to me.
And also to continue on the speaker's responsibility, and for example, this is a different type of a communication theory. It's not the same thing as the bubble that I was talking about earlier. But for example, my message is my message, right? My talk, whatever I say, is whatever comes from me.
Mm-hmm.
It's it is my responsibility to be able to explain myself as best as I can. Mm-hmm. In terms of the audience's responsibility, it is a responsibility of them to interpret, but that's a given. They will interpret as whatever they can, right? I still do think that the audience needs to understand the weird nebulousness, the weird unknowability of what the other person is saying. They should consider that. But it is, I think it's absolutely true that if it's your message, I mean, it's your message, you know, you gotta take care of that like a little baby and know what you're talking about to who you're talking about, that, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Sure. So we did pride, we did romance, we did compassion.
I don't think we're done with pride. I'm just saying. I think it's going to be a two-part, honestly.
All right. What do we have left? Community, justice, and faith.
I actually have a little poem about pride. Actually,
all right.
One of the benefits of pride.
I think what we should do is do a poem.
We have 15 minutes, so yeah, let's do a poem.
Still have 15 minutes left?
We only have 15 minutes left.
Okay, we'll do a poem, we'll do a song, and maybe we'll have our final thoughts about pride or whatever.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, we're going to have to do a part two on this one, guys.
Sean's going to read a poem. Thanks, Colin. I'll be home in a little bit.
All right, signing off.
All right, thank you, Bailey.
Good talking to you, Bailey.
All right.
So this poem addresses pride used in a positive sense.
Okay.
Not excessive pride that leans toward ambition or belittles fellow creatures. It's a very famous poem. It's by Richard Lovelace, who was born in 1618. It's called To Lucasta, On Going to the Wars. Tell me not, sweet, I am unkind, that from the nunnery of thy chaste breast and quiet mind to war and arms I fly. True, a new mistress now I chase, the first foe in the field, and with a stronger faith embrace a sword, a horse, a shield. Yet this inconstancy is such as you too shall adore. I could not love thee, dear, so much, loved I not honor more.
Hello, we are back. We have 9 minutes remaining in this episode of Our Thoughts Tonight.
I think we're going to have some final thoughts about Pride and probably leave this for a future episode. Mm-hmm. Next episode might be mythology. We might come back to these values in the future. If the next episode is not mythology,
yeah.
I suppose we finish.
How many values do we have left?
We have community, justice, and I suppose since we're doing a part two, we can probably tackle faith as well for a sixth one.
Thanks to Zach and Bailey for calling.
Yeah. Damn, two callers. Is that a record?
That is a record, except there are two people we know. But
yeah. I just want to give my two cents about Pride here. You know, I am a big believer, really, in Schopenhauer and the will. And at the end of the day, I think that, again, these are closing thoughts, I suppose, but at the end of the day, all we have is ourselves, and all we have is our drives and our actions, and whatever we do ultimately is to the benefit of us, right? Even things like compassion, I think, are things that help us, whether in a literal sense of being nice to someone and how it provides back to you, or also doing compassion because it fulfills your value of compassion. It fulfills your value and your belief in that ideal. And so you thus do compassion. So I think Pride is ultimately the most intrinsic, most internal value that we have. And I don't know, you know, I'm going to differ with Schopenhauer here. I don't think it's overall a bad thing, because I think we're talking a little bit about this before we came on, went live right now. And, you know, I basically, when I think of something bad, I think of that thing being non-usable, foreign, and overall something that is not intrinsic to someone. I can't call myself bad, mostly because what are you at that point? There, you must have some sort of stability or some sort of core that is not bad. And if pride really is at the heart of all of us, I don't think you can consider all that. I don't think you can consider that pride. That sounds very weird, but I just think that you can't go outside of pride. I don't think you can ever escape pride. And to call it bad, I think doesn't do anything really at that point. It's just, again, you know, Sean was mentioning degrees. I think overall it's a type of pride. I think there is, it's a hot tool that you need to manage somehow. Or maybe we all just will die because of pride. But I think that's just my belief. That overall, pride is intrinsically neutral, maybe good, but there is a lot of risk involved with it. I suppose that would be my stance. Any closing thoughts? Anybody?
You go ahead, Sean. Sorry.
As Murat thinks, I put on the spot. I agree with you entirely. I think pride is an essential part of the human character. And we wouldn't be able to hold our heads high among our friends if we didn't have a certain amount of pride to uphold our views. Excessive pride is where the human creature starts to falter. But pride is a matter of selfhood. It's a matter of looking out, well, not necessarily looking out for ourselves, but just believing in ourselves, you know, looking out for the self. No, not even looking out for the self. That's wrong too, because that's selfish. But just being able to hold the head high and say, this is what I believe.
I think you go even in a much more metaphysical way, if I want to go that route. I think at the end of the day, all we have is ourselves. It's our cognition. It's our reality. It's our entire worlds. All we have is self at that point. I was going to mention Nietzsche's Übermensch, but I don't think I have time about that. But obviously the Übermensch is a very prideful archetype, I suppose.
But prideful in a good way or bad way?
Prideful in a good way in regards to Nietzsche. But it's still a little bit, again, I just can't consider pride anything but just yourself at that point, because all you have at the end of the day is yourself. But Rod, do you have enough? I know you're looking at something, but
yeah. I think I have it here. It's nothing that I I thought of. I'm looking for it. Hold on. It's a good one. I had it here a second ago.
Was it about pride?
It is about pride, but I'm just stupid and I lost it.
Do you remember?
It's a quote by François de la Rochefoucauld, and it's pretty good, but I can't remember. I can't find it. Yeah. Anyway, I can't find it because. No, it was one of these, but anyway. I can't remember what it was, honestly. I read through 100 of them. And there was one I was specifically looking for, but I couldn't find it. So if I find it, I'll put it on the next episode.
Yeah.
It was a good quote, though.
Yeah.
Oh, really quickly. Really fast. The last song that was played was an artist in Turkey, who his name on Bandcamp is Ateşehir. Was Ateşehir, and the album was called AVM. I think it's the music is great, but the titles are some of the most hilarious things out there. I forget the name of the song, but it was something along the lines of "I found what I wanted, but it wasn't the right size or color."
They had the right color, but the wrong size or something.
Yeah, yeah. So I just encourage everybody to go check that out because
I found the quote. It's by François de la Rochefoucauld, which was a French scholar or something. And the episode's gonna end before I can read this quote. Few people, and this has to do with pride, kind of. Few people have the wisdom to prefer the criticism that would do them good to the praise that deceives them. And I think that's kind of like we're too, you know, prideful to accept our own faults. I didn't think of it, obviously. I just thought of him when we start talking about this.
Yeah.
And Sean's got one more poem for us.
Okay, let's go, yeah.
So will this finish the show then?
Yeah.
Timing good? Okay. I think this is a good poem in regards to pride and how this knowledge tempers pride. It's by a little-known late Renaissance composer named James Shirley, who was born in 1596 and died in 1666. It's called Death the Leveler. The glories of our blood and state are shadows, not substantial things. There is no armor against fate. Death lays his icy hand on kings. Scepter and crown must tumble down and in the dust be equal made with a poor, crooked scythe and spade. Some men with swords may reap the field and plant fresh laurels where they kill. But their strong nerves at last must yield. They tame but one another still. Early or late, they stoop to fate and must give up their murmuring when they, pale captives, creep to death. The garlands wither on your brow, then boast no more your mighty deeds. Upon death's purple altar now, see where the victor victim bleeds. Your heads must come to the cold tomb. Only the actions of the just smell sweet and blossom in their dust.